You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity. All right, today we are tackling something, well, invisible. A system working behind the scenes that honestly can make or break almost every anesthetic.
You're talking about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, RAA.
Exactly. We're calling it anesthesia's invisible hemodynamic circuit. Or maybe the body's hidden thermostat.
That's a great way to put it. It's the thermostat everyone forgets is even plugged in. And you're absolutely right. Every single drug we give, you know, your induction agent choice, how deep you run your gas, your pressors, it all interacts with RAS.
And the stakes are, well, they're huge. Understanding that interaction is the difference between a patient's pressure just sort of dipping gracefully after induction.
Or completely falling off a cliff, a catastrophic collapse. It's that serious.
That distinction is everything. So we're not just here to like list the steps. We're on a mission, really.
Yeah, the goal here is to unpack the actual molecular blueprint of RAS. Huh? Why? So that you, listening, can move beyond just chasing numbers.
Towards achieving what we're calling the P model of anesthesia management. That's predict, prevent, and personalize.
Predict, prevent, personalize. Love it. Mm-hmm. And to do that, we absolutely have to start at the source. We need to go right into the kidney.
The command center, right. The juxtaglomerular apparatus, the JGA.
That's it. Think of the JGA as ground zero for the whole RAAS circuit.
Okay, let's dig into this JGA. What always gets me is the redundancy. The body isn't just relying on one signal, is it? It's got these three tiny separate sensors.
Mm-hmm. All monitoring the internal circuits constantly. It needs that backup because, well, pressure and volume are life or death critical.
So what's sensor number one?
The most direct one, maybe. The intrarenal baroreceptors. They're literally just sensing stretch in the afferent arteriole.
Less blood flow, less stretch.
Exactly. Less stretch equals low pressure. And the immediate response. Release renin. Simple cause and effect. Low pressure, initiate the fix.
Okay, straightforward. Then there's the nerve input.
Right, the central nervous system gets its say via the vanadargic receptors on the JGA cells. They respond to sympathetic tone, those adrenaline whispers, as the source material calls them.
So even a little bit of stress or sympathetic drive tells the kidney, hey, maybe tighten things up.
Precisely. It adds another layer, triggering renin release to anticipate or respond to systemic stress.
And the third one, the one you find most interesting.
Ah, yes, the macula densa. This is fascinating. It's like a little sodium detective sitting right there in the distal tubule.
A sodium detective. Okay, so it's tasting the fluid going by. What's it looking for?
It's monitoring the salt, specifically the chloride concentration, delivered to that part of the kidney.
And how does that connect back to pressure in the OR? Say it detects low sodium. What happens?
Well, if not much sodium is getting that far down the tubule, the body interprets that as low overall volume or perfusion. Dehydration, maybe, or low cardiac output.
Makes sense.
So low sodium delivery is a signal to the JGA, hey, we need to hold on to volume and boost the pressure. It triggers renin release through local signals like prostaglandins and even ATP.
Okay, three sensors all feeding into this renin release decision. But here's where we hit our first big aha moment for anesthesia providers. Anesthetic interference.
Yes. We actively mess with this system. Our volatile anesthetics, you know, SIBO, ISO, they act like noise-canceling headphones on the JGA.
How so? Which part do they block?
They significantly blunt that crucial BR signaling. They dampen the renal sympathetic tone.
Ah, so the adrenaline whispers get ignored.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the consequence is huge. That initial rapid RAAS response you should get when blood pressure drops, it's delayed. It's sluggish.
So the patient's MAP tanks right after induction, and the kidney is just slow to react because our sevoflurane is muffling the signal.
Precisely. You're already behind the curve. That muted response almost guarantees you'll be reaching for pressors earlier than you might otherwise need to.
Okay, so that sets us up for trouble early. Now let's assume renin does get released eventually. What's the next step in this cascade?
Renin finds its substrate, angiotensinogen, floating around, chops off a piece, and makes angiotensin the first.
Which isn't really the main actor yet, right?
No. Angiotensin is mostly just an intermediate. It travels through the bloodstream, and primarily when it hits the lungs, the ACE enzyme, angiotensin-converting enzyme, gets hold of it.
Found mostly in the lung endothelium.
Yep, that's where most of the conversion happens. Mm. ACE converts angiotensin I into the star player, angiotensin the second, ANG2. That's the primary effector molecule.
ANG2. And this molecule, it's got like a split personality. Let's talk about the tough side first, the ATR receptor.
Right. Think of ATRs as the strict commander. When ANG2 binds here, It's all about immediate, powerful action.
What kind of action?
It activates a pathway called G-coupled signaling. The end result, it floods the vascular smooth muscle cells with intracellular calcium. Massive calcium flood.
And calcium in muscle cells means?
Contraction. Intense systemic vasoconstriction. Squeezes everything. Plus, it facilitates more norepinephrine release from nerves and tells the adrenal gland to release aldosterone for volume. It's the body's main pressor arm, no question.
Okay, that's the brute force response. Squeeze hard, hold volume. But then there's this other receptor, the ATR's receptor, the gentle counterpart. Why?
It seems completely counterintuitive at first glance, doesn't it? ATR activation actually promotes vasodilation, helps release bradykinin, stimulates nitric oxide.
Wait, so Ang-2 binds to ATR and causes vasodilation. Why would the body do that when it's trying to raise pressure with ATR?
It's about balance, especially long term. Think of ATR as the counter-regulatory brake. It prevents the ATR system from going totally overboard, potentially causing dangerous hypertension or damaging tissues. It promotes tissue repair, keeps things in check. It's the essential yin to the ATR yang.
Okay, that long-term balance makes sense. But this duality, this yin and yang, leads straight into our second huge AHA moment, especially for our patients on chronic meds.
Absolutely critical. We're talking about the receptor shift. Think about your patient who takes an ACE inhibitor, like lisinopril, or an ARB, like losartan, every single day.
They're chronically blocking that ATR strict commander pathway.
Day in, day out. That chronic blockade does something profound. It shifts the entire signaling balance in their vascular system towards ATR dominance.
So the vasodilating side, the gentle counterpart, becomes the main signal pathway left open.
That's exactly it. And this isn't just theory. This is the molecular reason why those patients can be so incredibly resistant to our standard catecholamine pressors like norepinephrine or phenylephrine.
Ah, okay. So the patient clashes after induction. You push Neo. Neo primarily works through alpha-1 receptors, but its effectiveness is often synergistic with or relies on a functioning background ATR tone, which isn't there.
Right. Or maybe the ATR pathway itself is directly blocked by their ARB.
Yeah.
You're trying to send a signal down a pathway that's been effectively shut down by their chronic medication. The vasodilatory ATR signals are relatively unopposed.
You're pushing more and more catecholamine, but it feels like pushing on a string because the target receptors or the downstream effects are muted or blocked.
That's the feeling, that clinical dread when the usual tools aren't working. It's the receptor shift in action.
While we're talking about ACE, the enzyme that makes Ang-2, there's that other job it has, right? The hidden role.
Yes, very important point. ACE doesn't just make angiotensin II. It also breaks down another substance called bradykinin.
Bradykinin. Yeah. That's a vasodilator, but it also does other things.
It's a potent vasodilator, yes, which is part of how ACE inhibitors help lower blood pressure. But if you block ACE with an inhibitor, bradykinin levels go up because it's not being broken down.
And that accumulation is mostly good for blood pressure, but it's the culprit behind.
Angioedema, that rare but potentially catastrophic airway swelling. It's the bradykinin buildup. That's the biochemical fine print we absolutely need to remember, especially concerning airway management.
Okay, so understanding that is key for managing ACE inhibitors perioperatively. Let's pivot now and map this onto what we actually see happen minute by minute after induction.
Yeah, that classic terrifying pattern.
0 to 2 minutes, you push the propofol, maybe add some fentanyl, boom. Sympathetic tone drops, vasodilation, MAP plummets.
Standard sympathetic collapse.
Yeah.
Happens fast.
Then, okay, minute 2 to 5. This is where RAAS should be kicking in hard to compensate, right?
It should be. Renin release, Ang-2 production. But as we said, if you've got volatile anesthetic on board, or if the patient is on an ACE inhibitor or ARB,
that response is blunted, delayed, muffled.
Exactly. The cavalry is slow to arrive, or maybe it can't even get through.
Which brings us to the crisis zone, beyond 5 minutes. You've maybe given a fluid bolus, you've started norepinephrine, you're cranking up the dose, and the MAP is still stuck at like 55.
That right there is your working definition of vasoplegia in the OR.
So, practically speaking, how do we define that point where we say, okay, this isn't responding normally?
The common clinical definition is something like MAP persistently less than 65 mmHg despite giving adequate fluids, and it's unresponsive to escalating doses of standard catecholamines.
And high-dose norepinephrine is often considered what?
Usually around, or maybe above, 0.2 micrograms per kilo per minute. And remember the stats. Patients on chronic ACE inhibitors or ARBs often need 30, even 40% more vasopressor support right from the start.
Okay, so you're in that situation. refractory hypotension, catecholamines aren't working. We need a plan, a rescue algorithm.
A clear mental flowchart is essential. First step, always. Check the basics. Is it really refractory or did I miss something?
Okay.
Is the volume status truly adequate? Could the anesthetic be way too deep? Is there an underlying rhythm issue? Got to rule those out fast.
Okay, basics checked. Still hypotensive. Next.
A guided fluid challenge. Maybe 250, maybe 500 milliliters crystalloid given quickly. See if there's any response.
Still no good. MAP still low. You've already started or increased your norepinephrine. Maybe you're at that 0.2 milliliter kilohaman mark or higher.
Now is the critical decision point. You cannot wait. The moment you recognize catecholamine resistance, you have to pivot. Step four.
Which is?
Add vasopressin early. Don't wait until the norepinephrine is maxed out and the patient is crashing harder. Start a vasopressin infusion.
What kind of dose?
Typically start low, around 0.01 to 0.04 units per minute. Titrate it.
And then, if even vasopressin isn't enough?
Only then do you start thinking about the more specialized adjuncts, things like methylene blue, or if your institution has it, maybe even an angiotensin II infusion itself. But vasopressin is the key second-line agent.
Okay, this brings us to AHA moment number three, the molecular key. Why does vasopressin work? Why is it the magic bullet when high-dose norepinephrine fails?
It all comes down to the receptor and the pathway. Vasopressin doesn't care about alpha receptors or beta receptors or even AT receptors.
It uses its own system.
Completely separate. It activates the VO receptor. And the VO receptor, guess what pathway it uses inside the cell?
Let me guess. GQIP is calcium.
Bingo. The same calcium mobilizing pathway that ATers uses, but triggered by a totally different lock and key. It's chemically distinct, completely independent of the adrenergic system and the angiotensin system that's being blocked or is resistant.
So it's like the main highway, ATRO or alpha-1, is blocked due to the ARB or just profound shock state.
And vasopressin takes the side road. It's the auxiliary power line, the bypass route. It activates vasoconstriction through a pathway that's still wide open.
That's brilliant. It completely bypasses the roadblock.
It's why it can be so dramatically effective in vasoplegic shock. It accesses a working mechanism when the primary ones have failed.
An elegant molecular solution to a terrifying clinical problem.
Absolutely. Now, we've focused a lot on ANG2 and the immediate pressor effects, but we can't forget the final player, the RAAS acronym, aldosterone.
Right. ANG2 tells the adrenal cortex to release aldosterone. What's its main job?
If ANG2 is the immediate commander, aldosterone is the long-term strategist, the silent sculptor of volume.
How does it sculpt?
It goes to the kidneys, specifically the distal tubules and collecting ducts, and tells them to upregulate certain channels and pumps, primarily the ENaCE sodium channel and the NACHO-ATOS pump.
That effect.
Pull sodium back into the body like crazy. And where sodium goes.
Water follows, so it boosts volume retention long term.
Exactly. But there's a trade-off. To pull all that sodium in, the NACHO pump has to push potassium out. So aldosterone causes potassium excretion.
And that link RAS affecting potassium is where we run into some hidden dangers in the OR, particularly with muscle relaxants.
Oh, it's a huge deal. Think about a patient coming in who might be hyperkalemic, maybe from kidney disease, maybe from their ACE inhibitor, or a potassium-sparing diuretic like spironolactone.
High baseline potassium. What's the...
Succinylcholine. You give succinylcholine, which already causes a small potassium release by depolarizing the muscle membrane.
And if the baseline K+ is already high...
You get an exaggerated release. You can push potassium into dangerously high levels, risking arrhythmias, even cardiac arrest. The sources say it's like adding gasoline to an already charged synapse. Very risky.
Okay, hyperkalemia plus sex is bad. What about the flip side, hypokalemia? Maybe from diuretics that aren't potassium sparing.
Hypokalemia also causes problems. It tends to prolong the duration of action of our non-depolarizing muscle relaxants, like rocuronium or vecuronium.
Makes recovery slower, harder to reverse.
Exactly. It can make achieving adequate reversal and recovery of muscle strength much more difficult. So that electrolyte balance, heavily influenced by RAAS activity and our interventions, directly impacts neuromuscular blockade.
Given all these risks, the hemodynamic instability, the electrolyte issues, what's the bottom line? What's our perioperative strategy for patients on these RAAS drugs?
We need to be proactive. The general consensus and what we typically follow is this: if it's safe and feasible for the patient.
Stop ACE inhibitors about 24 hours before elective surgery.
And ARBs, which tend to hang around longer, stop those maybe 36 hours before.
And critically, when do you restart them?
Only restart them post-op once the patient is stable. Hemodynamically stable, good urine output, stable renal function, Reintroducing them too early, while things are still shaky, can cause problems all over again.
Okay, let's tie this all together. Bring those AHA moments back into one scenario, that classic case. The 68-year-old guy, hypertensive, he's on Losartan daily.
Okay, so right away, ARB on board. We know his ATR receptors are likely blocked or significantly downregulated. His system might be ATR dominant.
You induce him with propofol, standard dose, his MAP immediately crashes to 50.
Sympathetic collapse plus underlying RAAS inhibition. Yeah. Double whammy.
You give fluids, maybe a liter. You start norepinephrine. You push the dose up, 0.1, 0.15, 0.2 millisoleus kilojumin, maybe even higher. But that MAP just isn't coming up properly, still hovering around 60.
That's AHA moment two in action, the receptor shift. You're seeing that catecholamine resistance because the ATR pathway is functionally closed for business due to the Losartan.
Okay, we've hit the wall. Norepinephrine isn't working. The molecular lesson is screaming at us.
It is. The receptors aren't fundamentally broken. They're just blocked, or the pathway is inhibited. You need a different route.
So the move is?
Start vasopressin. AHA moment three. You add that 0.02 units of an infusion.
And what happens?
Within minutes, often quite dramatically, the pressure starts to rise smoothly back to 70, 75. You might even be able to wean the norepinephrine down.
Because vasopressin activated the VO receptors, used that GQ calcium pathway, and completely bypassed the blocked ATR system. It took the side road.
Exactly. The rescue worked because you understood why the first-line therapy failed at the molecular level and chose an agent that targeted an alternative open pathway.
That really highlights the power of understanding the mechanism. It lets you predict the failure and implement the right solution instead of just reacting with more of the same feeling drug.
And that brings us right back to where we started, the PO framework. Predict the potential for resistance based on their meds. Prevent profound collapse by being ready with alternatives. Personalize the pressor choice based on the underlying molecular state.
RAS truly is that silent partner, isn't it? Understanding its signals and crucially how our anesthetics interfere with it is key to moving from just reacting to blood pressure numbers.
To actually being predictive and proactive in managing hemodynamics, it's fundamental.
It really is. Such a vital system, often invisible, but absolutely fascinating when you unpack it. But before we sign off, any final provocative thought for our listeners to chew on?
Maybe just this. Every time you look at an arterial blood gas, especially the electrolytes like potassium, and you consider the patient's fluid balance, realize you're reading a story largely written by the activity of their renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. And that story profoundly influences everything from their vascular tone to their muscle relaxant sensitivity, maybe even their lung compliance on the ventilator. It connects more dots than we often realize.
A great point. RAAS is everywhere. Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.